The Parkers arrived in Austin on a chilly January day to find the city firmly in the grip of secession fever. Abraham Lincoln had been elected president the previous fall, and anti-union sentiment in Texas was in full cry. Austin was its center. Throughout the month of January, secessionists marched up and down the rutted dirt of Congress Avenue, the city's broad main street that was newly lined with sturdy limestone buildings. It climbed gently from the Colorado River toward the imposing new three-story domed state capitol, which was fronted by marble Ionic columns and a huge portico. The secessionists were in their glory. They were an unruly bunch, carrying torches and signs that condemned Lincoln and his abolitionist government. They held parades and marches on a moment's notice. One featured a loud brass band, a long line of carriages containing ladies who fluttered Texas flags, and a boisterous contingent of men on horseback, all led by Ranger Rip Ford, who pranced down the avenue on a white stallion. Texas flags flew everywhere, and there was even talk of a Second Republic. The air was cold and bracing, and Texans were in a high mood. The secession convention, which began on January 28th, featured an Olympian fight between Governor Houston, who opposed breaking away from the United States, and almost everyone else, who favored it. The old statesman delivered one of the greatest speeches of his career, pleading that it is not unmanly to pause and at least endeavor to avert the calamity. People listened respectfully to him, and then voted 171-6 in favor of secession. That took place on February 1, 1861. On April 12th, Confederate batteries opened fire on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, signaling the start of the Civil War. Into one of these volatile debates came Cynthia Ann Parker, cleaned up and dressed nicely by two prominent Austin women who had taken a special interest in her. They were showing her the splendors of the white man's world. She entered through the massive portico and climbed the stone steps to the gallery on the second floor, where she sat and listened to men debate an issue she could not possibly have comprehended in a language she did not remember. Still, she became visibly agitated. She took up her daughter and ran for the door. After she was tackled and brought back, she was always being tackled and brought back in those days, it occurred to her companions that she believed the men on the floor of the legislature were sitting in judgment of her. She thought they were deciding whether or not to put her to death. Here, too, Cynthia Ann and her daughter were objects of great curiosity. She was visited by very many, reported one newspaper, which meant that crowds of people came and stared at her. She was visibly distraught. She spoke sparely and only through an interpreter. At one point, she stated that she was surprised to discover that the Comanches were not, as she had supposed, the most numerous and powerful people in the world. Or at least that is what one newspaper reporter heard. While in Austin, she sat for a tintype, an early type of photograph. The resulting image shows a woman who has clearly been gussied up, though she looks deeply uncomfortable in her new clothes. Her hair is pulled back in what looks like some sort of net. She wears a patterned cotton blouse and a striped dress and what looks to be a woolen robe clasped at the neck. Her unusually large and work-scarred hands are crossed on her lap. Her gaze is direct, supplicating, and utterly miserable. Her misery notwithstanding, Isaac's plan worked. 2 months after their visit, the Texas legislature voted to grant Cynthia Ann a $100 a year pension for 5 years, plus a league of land, 4,428 acres. Here, too, she was treated as a special case. The money and land was not to come to her, but to be held in trust for her by her cousins Isaac Duke Parker and Benjamin Parker, as though they were the guardians of a minor or of a mentally infirm adult who was unable to speak for herself. Back in Birdville, Cynthia Ann continued to be disconsolate, living at her Uncle Isaac's house. She wept. She tried to escape. She refused to cooperate. Nothing changed. And so, in the hope that she might find greater happiness elsewhere, and perhaps also to get her out of Isaac's hair, she began a long and strange odyssey through the homes of various relatives that had the ultimate effect of taking her deeper and deeper into East Texas, farther and farther from the Great Plains, and thus from any hope that she could ever be reunited with her people. The first stop on this journey was the oddest of all. Hearing of her unhappiness with Isaac, Cynthia Ann's cousin William Parker and his wife, who lived 2 miles south of Isaac, had volunteered to take her in. His generosity seemed innocent enough, but William, as it turned out, was not acting out of charity. He had a very specific and entirely self-serving reason for inviting Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower to his home. Shortly after Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower moved, Cousin William sent a letter to a Texan named Coho Smith. Coho's real name was John Jeremiah Smith. His nickname came as the result of being wounded by a lance. Coho in Spanish means lame. He was one of those marginal, colorful characters who inhabited the Texas frontier in its early days. He recorded his adventures in a book of his own drawings and observations he dubbed his Cohographs. He was self-educated and fluent in a number of languages, including Comanche. As a boy, he had spent a year as a Comanche captive. At the time he received Parker's letter, sometime in late 1861, he was working as a Confederate cotton agent, though he had also worked as a teacher and cabinet maker. In the letter, Parker explained that Cynthia Ann had come to live with him and begged Smith to come to his house, a distance of 189 miles, to act as translator. He said that he and his wife were anxious to have a conversation with their new guest, who could not speak English. For whatever reason, Smith agreed and soon arrived at the Parker place. When he asked where Cynthia Ann was, Parker replied, "I saw her go out the gate about half an hour ago. Let us go and hunt her up. She is generally moping around here in these woods." They found her 100 yards from the house, sitting on a log, with her elbows on her knees and her hands to her face. She wore an old sunbonnet. Prairie Flower was playing on the ground. She had constructed a small corral of sticks and was talking to herself in Comanche. William indicated to his cousin that dinner was ready by shoving his hand down his throat. Cynthia Ann shot a sharp, disapproving glance at Smith, then began to follow them back to the house. His wife explained to Smith that so many people came to see her that it annoyed her. "That is why she looked at you so spitefully." She was still a figure of curiosity, still being gawked at. Back at the house, Smith spoke to her in Comanche. "E wanikim," he said, which meant, "come here." According to Smith, her reaction was immediate and almost violent. She sprang with a scream and knocked about half the dishes off the table, scaring Mr. Parker. She ran around to me and fell on the floor and caught me around both ankles, crying in Comanche, "Ima mimiro," meaning, "I am going with you." Now she came fully alive. Sitting on a chair next to Smith, she held him by one arm, talking all the time to me in Comanche and Spanish, mixing the two languages all the time. Her Spanish was surprisingly good. She would not eat, but kept talking instead. "Oh, don't eat," she said in Comanche. "Let us talk. Oh, my friend, do let us talk." Then she switched to Spanish and said something that did not make any sense. "I want to go back to my 2 boys, and Billy there has told me by signs that he wants to go to my people also." I said, "Billy, do you want to go to the Comanches?" He said, "Yes, I do. And that is why I sent for you to interpret, for it is this way." Perplexed, Smith then asked William Parker what she meant. Parker, at length, explained. He told Smith that he had served in the Confederate Army. A Union bullet had shattered his thigh bone and had partly crippled him. He was not crippled enough, however, to avoid being sent back to the war by the conscription officers he called dad-blasted heel flies. The prospect terrified him, as did the notion of being hanged or shot as a deserter. Like thousands of other young men in the Confederate States, Parker had rushed to the recruiting posts in 1861 in anticipation of a brief and glorious war. Now he wanted out. He was desperate. And he had a plan. "I want you to take me and Cynthia Ann to the Comanches," he told Smith. "I can stay with them until this cruel war is over." The idea was absurd, as though he conceived of the Comanche tribe as a sort of rooming house where he could stay for a few years. Somehow, Cynthia Ann had been able to grasp this idea clearly and to comprehend that Smith had been summoned for this reason. The two Parker relatives had obviously found a way to communicate. Smith, who had no interest in such a venture, for which he, too, could be hanged, offered the weak excuse that there were no horses available. "Horses?" Cynthia Ann exclaimed. "That is nothing. There is some first-rate horses running here. Don't hesitate a moment about the horses." "Oh, I tell you, mi corazón está llorando todo el tiempo por mis dos hijos. My heart is crying all the time for my two sons." Then, switching back to Comanche, she said, "En sacasok bukunisua?" "Do you want a heap of horses?" Then again in Spanish, "No más lleva mí." "Only take me." She offered Smith all the girls or wives he wanted. She offered 10 guns, 10 horses, 10 wives. Cynthia Ann's harangue, Smith wrote, continued into the early morning hours. When Smith asked why she and Billy could not go by themselves, she answered that she thought he would be killed and she would be made a slave. She had an idea that Coho was tougher than William Parker, the cripple and coward. She was probably right. And of course Smith spoke the Comanche language. The next day, Parker took Smith out to see his illegal still, which he had built following the directions in a book entitled 1,000 Things Worth Knowing, then made one last effort to convince him to help, offering Smith the deed to more than half his 80 acres. "They will never get me in the army again," he said. "I will suicide first." Smith again refused. He later heard that Parker had managed to find his way to Illinois anyway, and had thus escaped the war. The last thing Smith remembered Cynthia Ann saying was, "Si le doy, o mi gente si le doy, todos las muchachas que si quiere, pero bonito y buen mozas." "I will give you, or my people will give you, all the girls you want, but pretty and well-made." He refused that, too. It must have broken her heart. Coho Smith captured Cynthia Ann as no one else has. Other people saw her as sullen, brooding, unresponsive, detached, despondent, even crazy, or at least so far sunk in savagery as to be irredeemable. In Smith's account, she was smart, aggressive, focused, strong-willed, and intensely practical. She was completely aware of what she wanted, and, at least for that brief moment, of how to get it. Her tragedy was that such a woman was utterly helpless to change the destiny that her family had, with the best of intentions, arranged for her. In early 1862, Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower moved yet again, this time to the home of her younger brother, Silas Jr. He had also been at the fort when it was raided, along with his 3 siblings. For some reason, the Indians had taken Cynthia Ann and John and had spared Silas Jr. and Orlena. Silas and his wife Ann lived with their 3 children in Van Zandt County, deep in the piney woods of East Texas, 27 miles northwest of Tyler. If Cynthia Ann had despaired of getting back home when she was living in Birdville, she was now more than 100 miles east. She was no longer even near the frontier. She must have understood this as they traveled. She was leaving the prairies, heading for the high timber. She must have known she was never getting out. Life was no better with Silas, who was 28 at the time, and stuttered. She did not get along with his wife, who punished Prairie Flower, who was often called Topsanna or Texan, every time she called her mother by her Comanche name. Cynthia Ann kept trying to escape, walking off down the road with her daughter in her arms, whenever she was left alone. She said she was going home, just going home. She often slashed her arms and breasts with a knife, drawing blood. This was probably an act of mourning for the death of her husband. Or it could have been a simple expression of misery. On one occasion, she took a butcher knife and cut off her hair. It was around this time that a photograph was taken of Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower that would become famous on the frontier and beyond. They had gone visiting in Fort Worth in the company of Silas, probably dragged along so she would not escape, and had somehow, perhaps at Silas's urging, landed in the photography studio of a man named A.F. Corning. The result was an exceptional and luminous portrait of mother and daughter. In it, Cynthia Ann wears a plain cotton blouse with a kerchief tied loosely at the neck. Her board-straight, medium-brown hair is cropped short. Perhaps this was the result of the butcher knife incident. Her eyes are light and transparent, her gaze disarmingly direct. Again, we see the large, muscular hands and thick wrists. What is most extraordinary about the portrait, however, is Cynthia Ann's exposed right breast, at which the black-haired, swaddled, and obviously quite pretty Prairie Flower is nursing. There is probably no precedent for this sort of photography on the Texas frontier in 1862. White women were not photographed with their breasts exposed. And even if a photographer had taken such a photo, no newspaper would have published it. This one was different. It became the picture of Cynthia Ann that generations of schoolchildren knew. It is still in wide circulation. The only explanation is that because Cynthia Ann was seen and treated as a savage, even though she was as white as any Scots-Irish settler in the South. The double standard is similar to the one National Geographic magazine famously applied in the mid-20th century to photographs of naked African women. The magazine would never have considered showing the breasts of a white woman in its pages. This explains part of the fascination with Cynthia Ann, the sense that, though her skin was white, something darker and more primal lurked beneath. In April 1862, Silas joined the Confederate Army, leaving his pregnant wife to care for their three children and also act as jailer for Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower. Ann soon put a stop to it, and Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower were shipped off yet again, this time to her sister Orlena, who also lived in the vicinity of Tyler, with her husband J.R. O'Quinn. Mother and daughter were moved to a separate house. Now, perhaps because of her growing realization that she was never going back to the Comanches, Cynthia Ann began to adjust. The Civil War had taken most of the able-bodied men, leaving the women to pick up the slack. Cynthia Ann began to relearn English, and in one account, could eventually speak it when she wanted to. She learned how to spin, weave, and sew, and became quite adept at it. Her Comanche experience had taught her how to tan hides, and she became known as the best tanner in the county. According to a neighbor, she was stout and weighed about 140 pounds, well-made, and liked to work. She had a wild expression and would look down when people looked at her. She could use an axe equal to a man and disliked a lazy person. She was an expert in tanning hides with the hair on them, or plaiting or knitting either ropes or whips. She thought her two boys were lost on the prairie. This dissatisfied her very much. Part of this adjustment, too, was her reintegration into the Parker family. Many of her relatives lived nearby, and she saw them with some regularity. She had friends, too, in a sense, at least people she could talk to. She even remembered some of the people from the old days. Every Sunday, one of them would take Prairie Flower visiting. The child had learned English quickly and soon spoke it more often than Comanche. She even went to a nearby school. In the account of Cynthia Ann's relative Tom Champion, she had a sunny disposition and was an open-hearted, good woman and always ready to help somebody. Most others had a different view. She was seen weeping on the porch or hiding herself from gawkers who never stopped coming to see the infamous White Squaw. and there was nothing sunny about her refusal to abandon many of her Indian ways, slicing her body with a knife whenever a family member died, and singing her high-pitched, keening songs of Comanche mourning. She had never forgotten. She had only accommodated. She probably stopped believing the Parker family's promises, which they repeated to the end, that she would be allowed to see her sons again. They had always been empty promises. According to T.J. Gates, one of Cynthia Ann's neighbors, she spoke often of the loss of her two sons. "I well remember Cynthia Ann Parker and her little Towks. She lived at this time about 6 miles south of the town of Ben Wheeler with her brother-in-law Ruff O'Quinn near Slater's Creek. She thought her two boys were lost on the prairie after she was captured. She would take a knife and hack at her breast until it would bleed, and then put the blood on some tobacco and cry for her lost boys." Champion had the same impression. "I don't think she ever knew but that her sons were killed," he wrote. "And to hear her tell of the happy days of the Indian dances and see the excitement and pure joy which shone on her face, the memory of it, I am convinced that the white people did more harm by keeping her away from them than the Indians did by taking her at first." Whatever chance she may have had at contentment was destroyed in 1864 when Prairie Flower died of influenza and pneumonia. The little girl's death shattered her. Now there was nothing left of her Comanche life but memories. What her day-to-day life was like in the years after that is largely unknown. The Comanche version is unambiguous. The white men broke her spirit and made her a misfit. She became bitter over her enforced captivity, refused to eat, and eventually starved herself to death. She lived 6 more years until 1870, when she died of influenza, which may have well been complicated by self-starvation. A coffin was built for her by relatives. A bone pin was put in her hair, and they buried her in the Foster Cemetery, 4 miles south of the town of Poynter, which lies between the larger towns of Tyler and Palestine. It is perhaps fitting for someone who had endured so many changes against her will that before she came to her final resting place, she was buried 3 times in 3 different cemeteries. Who was she in the end? A white woman by birth, yes, but also a relic of old Comancheria, of the fading empire of high grass and fat summer moons and buffalo herds that blackened the horizon. She had seen all of that death and glory. She had been a chief's wife. She had lived free on the high, infinite plains as her adopted race had, in the very last place in the North American continent where anyone would ever live or run free. She had died in deep pine woods where there was no horizon, where you could see nothing at all. The woods were just a prison. As far as we know, she died without the slightest comprehension of what happened to her, what larger forces had conspired to take her away from her old life. One thinks of Cynthia Ann on the immensity of the plains, a small figure in buckskin, bending to her chores by a diamond-clear stream. It is late autumn, the end of warring and buffalo hunting. Above her looms a single cottonwood tree, gone bright yellow in the season, its leaves and branches framing a deep blue sky. Maybe she lifts her head to see the children and dogs playing in the prairie grass, and beyond them, the coils of smoke rising into the gathering twilight from 100 lodge fires. And maybe she thinks, just for a moment, that all is right in the world.